Just a brief diversion before we get into the lesson itself. Turn with me, if you will, to Acts chapter 2. Verse 42. Here the church began. 3,000 plus people were baptized, at least 3,000 in that neighborhood. And what do you find the apostles doing? Yes, they gathered for worship, but note, if you will, they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching. And then when you get to chapter 5, at the end of the chapter, you'll note it says that the last phrase in the verse 42, they kept right on teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ. When you get to chapter 8 and verse 4, you find these disciples scattered because of the persecution. And it says they went everywhere preaching the word. Don't think of standing behind a pulpit, but it's proclaiming the gospel as opportunity presented itself. Would they have been able to without this teaching program? We just prayed with Stephen that our gathering here today would better equip us to be able to address in this world what's not in conformity with God's ways. And if there's ever an area that's not in conformity with God's ways in society and even in religion, it's the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Are we equipping ourselves to be able to meet those issues, try to correct people's thinking, and avoid letting ourselves get entangled in that? That's what these classes are for. In the 11th chapter of the book of Acts, when you get to verse 26, here's a new church in Antioch. And again, you see the emphasis on teaching. It says, for an entire year, verse 26, they met with the church and taught considerable numbers. It's interesting, in the church of Jerusalem, you had this intensive teaching program. And when you get to chapter 8, and those disciples were scattered, they were equipped to teach the word. When you get to Acts 11, 26, you read about this intensive teaching program in the church at Antioch. And when you get to chapter 13 and verse 1, it says there were prophets and teachers there. Same thing in chapter 15. And so this is God's plan. Somebody says, where is the verse that says we ought to be interested in attending Bible class together and study together? These are just a few that could be cited. And if you prayed the prayer with Stephen, then you certainly ask God to help you be able to do that. And that's what the purpose of these classes are for. So marriage and divorce and remarriage is not a pleasant topic, but it's one that's very needed because the ways of men are so foreign to God's plan, and we want to try to equip ourselves to see the truth. So what we're looking at this part of our study are various positions that are held. We studied, first of all, in the first part of our course, very critical in the first two lessons, attitudes that affect our understanding. But then we talked about the definition of four terms: marriage, divorce, adultery, and fornication. And then we plugged those definitions into the verses that were pertinent. And now we've been looking at the various positions that are held by sometimes very good brethren, very capable brethren. But the question is not do I like them, do I like to hear them preach, but the question is it truth? That's the issue. And so we're looking at a couple more in our study here today. We'll start at Matthew chapter 5 and verse 30. I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, New American Standard, or fornication, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. One thing I found very interesting, this is practical application. We talk about how these verses are interpreted. And I found in some cases in point that I've been involved in where I just found out that people were in a marriage that was questionable. So I just said, here, read this verse, either Matthew 5 or Matthew 19. I didn't tell them what I thought it meant. said, you read this verse, you tell me what it means. They told me exactly what it meant. They didn't know anything. They hadn't been going to church, but they could read it and understand it. The problem is that we sometimes have help in misunderstanding it, trying to read things that aren't there. And so if we can get back to just looking at the text and not letting other influences divert us from what the text says. But here is a position that's held, that Jesus is dealing with principles. Let me stop right there in this particular position. If somebody said Jesus is dealing with principles, would you agree or disagree?
Agree,
certainly. I agree dealing with principles, but look at the little word so. And it's what we do with what we have concluded. Is our reasoning valid? That's the question. Sometimes we're not logical in our conclusions. So we cannot take what he says literally and state it as law. He is dealing with principles, but that conclusion is not demanded. So that's what we have on the answer number one. Because Jesus is dealing with principles, it does not mean that nothing he says should be taken literally as prohibitive law. I don't know if you went and looked up the definition of principle, but I found the definition very interesting in dictionaries. Here's one from Webster's New World Dictionary. And it says, it says a fundamental truth, law, or rule of conduct upon which others are based. Note, a principle can be a law, a rule of conduct, but it's fundamental, and therefore other principles are based upon it. And so, yes, he's dealing with principles, but that does not mean they're not laws. It does not mean they're not prohibitive. It does not mean there's not commandments involved. And that kind of reasoning is simply not the case. We've used an expression, you've been a member here, you've heard it, I think it's 3,238 times. Words are vehicles upon which thoughts travel. And that's so true with these words in marriage and divorce study, with any Bible study. So when we start using a word, leave, divorce, marriage, separate, principle, go check your definition. Go get a dictionary. But don't just consult one dictionary. Consult two or three. That's helpful. If it's a Bible word, you understand that what the dictionary is doing is telling you how people use the word, not what it meant when it was spoken or written in the first century. So always keep that in mind. So it's important to understand the various passengers on the bus and how the word can be used. And that will help clarify our understanding and help prepare us against false conclusions. In Matthew 22... Look at Matthew 22, 39, and 40. Most everybody in this audience can quote these, even if you don't recall the exact chapter and verse. So the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. Is that a principle? Sure.
Yes.
That is so fundamental. Now, the definition I read in the dictionary was, upon which others are based. All right? Now, look over at Romans chapter 13. This is not on your lesson, but you can remember this or write yourself a note. Is love your neighbor a principle upon which other rules of conduct are based? Here's Romans chapter 13. Note verse 8. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. That's what we read in Matthew 22. There's the principle. What are applications? How does it affect conduct every day specifically? All right, look, he says, for this, you shall not commit adultery. You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not covet. Are those rules of conduct? Yes. Are those laws? Yes. Yes, they are. And so he says, if there's any other commandment, I note this statement, it's summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So that commandment is the fundamental principle upon which don't commit adultery, don't murder, don't steal is based. Note he says, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. So when you read, you should not commit adultery, why shouldn't I commit adultery? Well, because God says so, and that's a good answer. But here's the consideration here. It hurts your neighbor. And love does no wrong to a neighbor. Why shouldn't I covet? Why shouldn't I steal? Why shouldn't I murder? It hurts your neighbor. Love your enemy says you don't do that which hurts your neighbor. So how, in our prayer with Stephen, we talked about so many concepts in the world contrary to the idea of our God. So people talk about, you know, they want to get married. I love this person so much. But you've been married and you were not divorced for the right reason, the legitimate reason that allows you to remarry. I know, but I love them so much. And so they marry. So they love them romantically. But do they love them like this? No. They're going to take them to hell with them. They're living in adultery. And so, understanding this concept of principle, a fundamental truth upon which others are based, in no way rules out the idea that it's law or that laws are involved and grow out of it. Go back to our text in Matthew 5. You note in verse 32, and we have this all the way through, beginning in verse 21 through the rest of chapter 5. You have heard that it was said, verse 22, but I say. Verse 27, you've heard that it was said, but I say. Verse 31, it was said, but I say. But I say, as you have here on the lesson, is an authoritative statement. Here's what you've heard. You went to the synagogue on Saturday, and here's what your leader said. Here's what your teacher said. But I say, is that not authoritative?
Yes,
that's authoritative. Here's the way you ought to conduct yourself. If you want to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, which is what this sermon is about, if you want to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, you've got to do everything in your power to preserve marriage, not find excuses to get out of marriage or form an illicit relationship. That's what I say to you. Now, the Jews thought by virtue of their race, they'd be citizens of the kingdom of heaven. They were mistaken. And so it's very authoritative. When you get to chapter 7 in verse 24, the people in the audience recognize that. In chapter 7, here in verse 24, whoever hears these words of mine and acts upon them, maybe compared to a wise man, the one who hears my words and does not act upon them is a foolish man. Now note verse 29. Well, let me start in 28. The result was that when Jesus finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching. Far. Why were they so amazed? Was it the sound of his voice, the appearance that he had on the mountaintop? No. For he was teaching them as one having authority, not as their scribes. You know, the scribes, they quote this scribe. This other group, quote that scribe. That's what a lot of people do today. They quote all the commentators down through the ages. Well, Augustine said this. Well, Pelagius said this. Well, this creed says this. And this guy said, who cares? What Jesus said is authoritative about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And about everything else he preached in that sermon. And everything he taught during his lifetime. And authorized his apostles to teach. And so if you act on what Jesus said, you're wise. You don't act on what Jesus said, he said you're foolish. And your house will come crumbling down. Very authoritative. Now, involved in this position is the idea that figurative language is involved in Matthew 5, which it is. And so the idea is figurative language is involved, therefore you can't take what he says literally. Again, that's false reasoning. That's not true. I admit figurative language is involved, but that doesn't mean that everything that he said is figurative and that there's nothing that he said is literal. And you'll note on your lesson here, we have the comment, did he warn against literal lust in verse 28? Whoever looks upon a woman to lust for her, is that literal or figurative? Lust. Is it literal lust? Yes. Yes. And then when you get to verse 44, he said, pray for those who persecute you. Is that literal prayer or figurative prayer? That's literal prayer. And so, yes, Jesus used some figurative language, but what a mistake it is then to brand everything he said is figurative and therefore no rule of law for our conduct. But that's the idea that is held. So here's what we have on your lesson. What he said was that literal divorce, verse 32, whoever divorces his wife severs the marriage relationship, except for literal fornication. This version translates unchastity, unfortunately. Some versions use sexual immorality, which is better. But the word fornication is good. People just need to learn what it means. And so fornication, and we talked about the definition of that word earlier, except for literal fornication, results in, he says, they commit adultery. That's literal adultery. So don't let somebody undermine your thinking with this kind of a concept about the principal concept. I have a paragraph here. Figurative language is found on every page of the Bible. Now, I haven't went through every page. I guess that's a hyperbole, but I think it may not even be a hyperbole. It may be accurate right down to the letter, unless you have one of these Bibles that has five words on one page, that kind of thing. But it's throughout your scriptures, figurative language. Now, to make everything in a context figurative because figurative language is used would mean nothing in the Bible is literal. Figurative and literal language are intertwined, and careful and honest exegesis must be employed to correctly interpret. You say, that makes it more difficult. You can say whatever you want. You can say, why did he use figurative language? Let's suppose we don't know why. The fact is, he did. I think I know why he did. Because figurative language serves to enhance. It serves to emphasize. That's the nature of figurative language. Instead of saying, you know, he was going fast, we say, man, he was flying 90 miles an hour down the road. Well, he wasn't flying. But it emphasizes. And that's the way we, with language, put a bold or put an exclamation point by figurative language. And so look at John 11, 11. Now, Jesus said to his disciples, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. But I go that I may awaken him out of sleep. The disciples therefore said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. He'll wake up. They missed the figure. So Jesus was talking about literal death, but used figurative language. And so John says Jesus has spoken of his death. Is death here literal in this verse?
Yes.
While Jesus used figurative language, he was talking about literal death. And so we understand that. We don't even stop to think about it. Look at Matthew 16, 6. Jesus told his disciples, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And they began to discuss among themselves, saying, oh, he's mad at us. We didn't take any bread. Did he talk about bread? Yes, leaven. That's what you put in bread. Did he mean bread? No. He meant, as the following discussion talks about, that he was talking about verse 11. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They understood that he wasn't talking about bread, but the teaching, it has a similar trait to leaven. It influences secretly and permeates the whole. Be careful of that teaching. Same thing with marriage and divorce, by the way. beware of the teaching on marriage and divorce. And we've tried to encourage this class to be discerning listeners. Don't believe it because I say it, because I'm the preacher. You study for yourself. Because false teaching, once it starts, it can permeate, it can spread, not only in your thinking, but in the thinking of others. And so figurative language and literal language is intertwined, and because historically, we are back in the first century, people have failed to grasp the meaning of figurative language. It leads to confusion. Back in our text in Matthew 5, in verse 29, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. Better for one of the parts of your body to perish than your whole body to be thrown into hell. And so a person trying to advocate this say, did he literally mean to pluck your eye out? Everybody knows he didn't. It's figurative language. It's a very strong figure in where you leave out the word like or as like you do in a simile. And so he says, if your right eye... He didn't say whatever is most important to you is like your right eye, or what's important to you is your right eye. He just said your right eye. It's a figure of speech. I know you love this word. It's called hypocatastasis. I know you remember that one. But it's like you say to somebody, you're like a beast. Or you could say, you are a beast. Or you could say, beast? That's what you got here. Your right eye evidently stands for whatever it is that's so important that would cause you to violate your marriage covenant. You're looking at that woman, you're lusting, you'd like to have her. You better do whatever it takes to avoid that. If it means quitting your job, quit your job. If it means moving, maybe you need to move. Whatever it takes. Why? He said it's better than going to hell. That's how important this is. But the fact that he used figurative language about that, does that mean hell is figurative?
No.
Why, no. No. And so, beware of this kind of thinking. Any further comments before I get to... Yes, sir.
So, it's interesting in your Matthew 16 passage, your passage, you men of little faith, you don't get it. I think that's interesting, and that's a warning to us to pay attention to this kind of figurative language, because Jesus was... irritated with the people with whom he has surrounded himself, that you weren't getting it.
That's an interesting comment, and we've noted that in class, you know, that it's interesting that Jesus expects people to think, to reason. And we don't like that, maybe, but it's challenging. He why did he do that? Well, he made us. Maybe he's appealing to a part of us that would weed out those who are really interested in serving God. I don't know. Maybe you can ask him when you get to heaven. But he did. Yes, Mark?
You mentioned earlier about the guy that loves the woman so much and he's willing to enter into an illicit relationship with her and then take her to hell with him ultimately as a consequence. People stop and think about the poor man that died and the rich man that died and the poor man went to Abraham's bosom. Interesting what the man who was informed had said. Can you send somebody back to the living and tell my kinfolk, don't come here? And haven't considered the consequences.
Right.
Don't come here.
And Abraham says, I'm going to ask somebody up there to work a miracle for your brothers, right?
No. Send them to Moses and the prophets.
Send them to Moses and the prophets, but I thought those guys were dead.
They're writing.
Moses is put by a figure of speech for his writings called metonymy. Right, good point. All right, Rocky.
Steve, in this position, it says that you can't take Jesus literally based on Matthew 5:32. But if you can't take Jesus literally based on Matthew 5:32, then he must be speaking figuratively.
Then what?
He's speaking figuratively. You're not taking his position literally. They're saying you can't take his position literally. Well, he's still talking, so if you can't take it literally, then he must be speaking figuratively. My point is, there's no indication here in Matthew 5:32. There may be no signs of figurative language. No indication that it triggers figurative language there. So, you know, if you think about that argument, it doesn't make sense. You don't have an indication right there. He's speaking figuratively.
All right. Josh, you had a comment?
want to talk about it after I understand too, because I don't want to derail, but you mentioned that there was, you know, the person can love their this spouse that they're in an explicit relationship with romantically, but not as a neighbor, because they may be bringing them to hell. And this may be kind of my misunderstanding about the neighbor relationship, but that isn't predicated on understanding the Bible in its entirety, completely. It's rather, this is neighbor to neighbor, Christian or not. Whereas this person who marries someone, they're entering in an explicit relationship. They love them. They also want to provide for them and protect them, do neighborly things towards them. They may not have come to the realization that they weren't being a good neighbor to them. It's like, how do you define being a bad neighbor? Is it you need to understand the Bibles, you know, completely, and then be following it as a Christian? Or is it, you know, the relationship is born not out of being a Christian, but just being a neighbor and, you know,
Well, it's certainly possible, and you bring up a good point, that someone may marry somebody not realizing they're going to work them harm, whereas they're going to get an adulterous relationship. And that's a good observation. You're right. The neighbor relationship does not grow out of being a Christian. It grows out of being a neighbor. It's common to all men. But let me make a parallel. I don't know if it's a good one. So somebody may give somebody something to drink, thinking it's good, when in fact it's poisonous. Maybe they picked up the wrong thing, and they give them something poisonous, and it kills them. There's a difference in that, and someone, they get that to give them something to drink. Somebody says, hey, you better watch that. That's dangerous. That could kill somebody. Look, I brewed this up. I want to give it to them. No, look, this is dangerous. This could cost their life. Here, drink it. That's what happens in marriage and divorce. They've heard warnings. Most people have read, well, I don't know if that's a good statement. I was going to say most people have read the Bible. A lot of them haven't. But maybe heard something about it. And so if there's a danger, you know, if somebody, you start to give somebody something to drink, somebody said, look, you better be careful. This could kill them. What do you do now? You don't know if that's so or not. Do you just ignore it? Say, here, drink it anyway. What do? See? So if there's a danger that could cost somebody their soul by marrying them, maybe, hey, let me put this on the shelf, go do a little thinking about this, have it examined a little bit further. But that's a good point that Josh brings up. I think, if I understand what you're talking about, that there may be people that marry someone they shouldn't, but they have no awareness of God's laws concerning that. And we certainly want to make allowance for that. Good point that Josh makes. Okay? But I think of people who've heard lessons on it, go to church, they have questions about it, they know there's issues, but they're going to stay with them because they love them. Really? Remember, there's three kinds of love. One is romantic love, and one is caring love. The other is sexual love. So they say, I love them. Well, you may love them romantically, but if you love them, care about them, that has to take precedence in your love for them. You do the same thing with your children. You love them, you like to hug them and kiss them, but sometimes you got to spank them because you care about them. Yes, sir?
There are also cases where somebody is in that situation, they didn't know, but they come to know. Now what are they going to do?
Good point. So they didn't know at the time, but now they stumble into the Church of Christ and humble, hear a lesson on marriage and divorce. Now what are they going to do? I'll probably go home and say, boy, that guy is crazy. We had a couple many years ago that started attending here, and it so happened I was teaching on marriage and divorce. He told me later, they went home, and he told his wife, that guy is crazy. He became a member here after it began, kept coming, listening, learning. But so if you hear it for the first time, you might think it's pretty nuts. But just read the text. I'm not afraid of somebody questioning it. I keep learning, keep trying to refine my thinking. I may be wrong. Help me if I'm wrong. I want to know. I can't always answer the questions like I'd like to. But that's the way we sharpen our sword. Iron sharpens iron. by putting things to the test, we can better refine our teaching. All right, let's go to 1 Corinthians 7. We had a whole class on Matthew 5. We had a class on 1 Corinthians 7. I say a whole class on Matthew 5. It's part of a class. But we had a couple classes on 1 Corinthians 7, and this is one of the verses we covered. And so you see I've got the little C, 15. Remember we told you that that's the class, that if you want to go back and get more detailed information, if you took notes, you can go back to class 15. Down at the bottom there, we've got Romans 7 referred to, and that was class 13. So you can go back to those classes. If you're not sure what we talked about, you can go to the website, download the audio if you wish, and actually have the class where we discuss those issues. So 1 Corinthians 7, 27 and 28, this particular position is that the divorced can remarry without sin. What's it based on? This verse. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. Now, the position is that released means divorced. Do not seek to be divorced. Are you divorced? Do not seek a wife. Look at number 3 under the answer. The New International Version, I think they've changed it. I think that's the reason I put the 1984 edition. But they, in the 84 edition, and your translations do change. Like I'm reading from the 77 edition of the New American Standard. There's a 95 edition. There's some things that have changed, some for the better, some for not as good. Now there's a 2020 version. Don't recommend it at all. But anyway, versions change. So sometimes it's good to compare that. You'll see in the New King James Version that you'll be in a class and ask somebody to read it. Here you've got it, and they don't read the same because the translators try to update. Sometimes they go backwards, sometimes they go forward. But anyway, in the New International Version, are you married? Do not seek a divorce. So if that's correct, then the next phrase is, he said, but if you should marry, you have not sinned. So if you are divorced and you marry, you haven't sinned. Divorce frees you. You haven't sinned. And so we just put a note there about that version. This is interpretation instead of translation. The word bound, New American Standard, King James, New King James, English Standard, ASV. That's a good way to compare versions, compare these major translations. Have the word bound. Is not the word used throughout the New Testament for married. It's not the same word. It's a different word. And this word is used in Romans 7 by the same writer discussing the same subject. And it's clear there that bound and married are not the same thing. Do you recall why? Go to Romans 7. Yeah, they've changed it.
And they said, do you not seek to be released? Are you free from a commitment? So they changed their interpretation.
For the better this time. Yes, that's good. And actually did pretty good on that, actually. It's an interpretation again, but it's a pretty good one. good observation Linda makes. Look at Romans 7. Here they have that word bound that Paul used here and used in 1 Corinthians 7. Same word, same subject, same writer. Here he says, you're bound by law as long as your husband lives. While the husband is living, here's your versions. King James says married. It's not the normal word for married. This version says is joined to another woman. That I don't know if that helps us a whole lot. One version says, becomes another man's. That is as good as you can get. That's what he wrote. He's talking about marriage. We studied in our definition of marriage that one of the synonymous phrases for marriage is to become ones. And so he's talking about being married. Paul's a Hebrew. He has the background of the Hebrew language and Old Testament. And so he says she becomes another man, not slave, not employee, wife. That's the idea. Now, who is she married to? The second man, correct? Who is she bound to? First man. Bound and marriage are not the same. You can show that if you're familiar with this passage. And so the idea to make 1 Corinthians 7:27, are you married to a wife, is a bad interpretation. So are you bound to a wife? Now, Linda mentioned the revision on the New International. They probably got to the heart of the matter, because in verse 25, who is he talking about starting in this section? Virgins. So, are you bound, committed, that idea by virtue of a betrothal or engagement? Do not seek to be released from that commitment. Now, he had said it's best not to be married, verse 26, because of a distress. And so he said, if you already entered into this commitment, you don't have to get out of it. But if you're free, now the word released in the English language often connotes what? Previously being bound. The word Paul used does not connote that. It's, are you free? And when we studied this chapter, I pointed out to you that the lexicons point that out and other versions translate it that way. And so it's not the idea that you were once bound and now you're free. You're free. You don't have a commitment. You don't have a bond. In that case, if you marry, you're not sinned. Let's suppose you don't know anything about the words, but you look at verse 28. Is there anything else in this chapter that tells you any divorced person cannot marry without sin? That's his position. If you're divorced, you can marry without sin. Is there anything else in this chapter that tells you that conclusion cannot be right?
Verse 39.
What?
Verse 39.
Okay, verse 39. How does that show you cannot, a divorced person cannot be, excuse me. Yeah, but Mr. Aldridge, I'm not bound anymore. I'm divorced.
Go back to definition.
Verse 11. Look at verse 11. When she leaves, what state is she in? Divorced, because she's unmarried. A person who was married, who is no longer married to that person, and that person is still alive, they are divorced. Now, if she marries, has she sinned? What is sin? Violation of the law. The law is, if she let her remain unmarried. So when she marries, she sins. I know then that verse 28 has to harmonize with that. We got two basic rules of Bible study, don't we? Everybody in here knows them. Context and harmony. So we've been looking at the context. But throughout this chapter, he's got various sections. He deals with the married in verse 10 and 11. Then he deals with those married to unbelievers, verse 12 through 16. Now he's dealing with virgins, verse 25. Stay with the context, and then you have the harmony. How you got to make verse, you say, I'm going to stick with, I like verse 28. I'll stay, that'll be my verse. If you want verse 11, go ahead. That's kind of like you're talking to one of your denominational friends. They say, I got John 3:16, whoever believes has eternal life. You say, but what about Acts 2:38? Well, you go ahead with your Acts 2:38. I'm staying with John 3:16. Can't do that with the Bible. You got to harmonize them. So there's some way John 3:16 and Acts 2:38 harmonizes. And the same thing here with verse 28 and verse 11. All right? So, We asked that question here on 2A. Oh, by the way, you'll note I see class 15. So if you go back to class 15, you get the notes that we had there. All right, so we just talked about 1 Corinthians 7, 10, and 11. And there's the answer to the question I just asked. Now, in Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9, if a person divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity and marries, now stop with me, this person is now in what state before they marry the second time? Huh? Whoever divorces his wife, what state are they in?
Divorce.
Divorce. And marries, what do they do? That's a commit adultery. But wait, verse 28 says you can marry and not sin. If you're divorced, you can marry and not sin is the position. That won't work. Here's a divorced person. When they marry, they sin. Same thing in Matthew 19, verse 9. And here, if you still have your Bible open to Romans 7, you have the same thing again. Here's a woman. She's married to a man, but then she's joined to another, not a second man, not two husbands, another, a different man. So she's divorced from the first man. She marries a second man. What is she?
An adulteress.
So, were you going to take this same writer, same subject? Am I going to interpret 1 Corinthians 7:28 contrary to what he wrote in verse 11, contrary to what he wrote in chapter 7? And as Todd has pointed out, down in the last part of the chapter, he says you're bound by law. Bound by law, not marriage, bound by law. You're not bound by marriage, you're bound by law. And that's an important distinction. Okay, my time is up. Thank you for your comments this morning. All right, we've got three more classes to go. The next lesson is on the table in the back if you don't have it. Thank you again.